Chapter 14 Deliverance. As always, after a Grant victory, Union soldiers engaged in no gloating as they watched their enemies being humbled. On the morning of July 4th, a hot, steamy day, Union men stared in respectful silence as their Confederate counterparts, one regiment at a time, marched out of Vicksburg, deposited their arms in stacks, then retreated to their lines. The hush seemed palpable after weeks in which the Navy had punished the town with more than 20,000 rounds of shell and shot. Grant wrote that not a cheer went up, not a remark was made that would give pain. Really, I believe there was a feeling of sadness just then in the breasts of most of the Union soldiers at seeing the dejection of their late antagonists. The extreme heat made the prolonged ritual an ordeal for both sides. As Grant's telegraph operator Samuel Beckwith recalled, the tramping of myriads of feet had stirred up a fine yellow clay dust that coated our garments and filled our eyes and ears and nostrils until it was almost unbearable. Grant had not simply notched another major victory. He had bagged a gigantic army, and nothing pleased him more, said an aide, than to reduce the enemy's strength by captures than by slaughter. The speed, daring, and sophistication of the Vicksburg campaign eclipsed anything Grant had accomplished before. More than 31,000 Southern soldiers fell under his control, joining 6,000 captured during the siege and 6,000 more in earlier battles after the river crossing. Adding to this bountiful harvest, Grant collected 17 rebel cannon and 60,000 muskets and rifles. By contrast, he had sacrificed fewer than 10,000 of his own men, prompting Bruce Catton to remark, "The legend of Grant as the heedless, conscienceless butcher finds nothing to feed on in the story of the Vicksburg campaign." Once the last Confederates surrendered, Grant ordered John Logan to lead his division into the fallen citadel and hoist the Stars and Stripes over Vicksburg's courthouse for the first time in 2.5 years. The siege damage was manifest everywhere, in toppled walls, shattered windows, and the emaciated faces of inhabitants. "The town was one vast cemetery," said one aide, "with skulls and limbs of buried soldiers protruding from the earth." Soldiers on both sides gazed at one another in wonder, the prosperous appearance of the Yankees no less surreal than the haggard faces of the famished Confederates. A Vicksburg woman, setting eyes on well-appointed Union men, wrote sadly, "What a contrast to the suffering creatures we had seen so long were these stalwart, well-fed men, so splendidly set up and accoutred. Sleek horses, polished arms, bright plumes. This was the pride and panoply of war." Union soldiers were roused to pity by their gaunt and hungry foes, and one officer started handing out hardtack, sugar, and coffee to every rebel soldier he saw. Grant was struck by how quickly the two sides began to mingle, retrieving their common nationality. Mortal hatred gave way to friendly banter. "I myself saw our men taking bread from their haversacks and giving it to the enemy they had so recently been engaged in starving out." For the first time, Grant toured the prehistoric apartments dug from the deep clay of the Vicksburg Hills by residents driven underground by his incessant bombing. Grant and his entourage repaired to a fine mansion whose front lawn had grown rank with weeds during the siege. As he mounted the wide front steps, Pemberton stepped onto the veranda and stood for a single moment glaring upon his conqueror, Beckwith said. The Confederate commander gruffly unbuckled his sword, belt, and revolver, and thrust more than offered them in surrender to Grant, who reacted with punctilious restraint. "Retain your sidearms, General," he told Pemberton, placing his hand softly upon the sword. When Grant offered him a cigar, Pemberton took one with exaggerated reluctance. He refused to offer Grant a seat, and when Grant asked for a glass of water, A rebel officer told him he could get it himself. Behaving with his congenital aplomb, Grant did not stoop to anger, and the contrast between the two generals struck observers. According to Charles A. Dana, Grant was received by Pemberton with more marked impertinence than at their former interview. Grant bore it like a philosopher, and in reply treated Pemberton with even gentler courtesy and dignity than before. Based on his pre-war experience, Grant knew a thing or two about the tender ego of a defeated man. As Pemberton foresaw, Vicksburg proved a full-blown catastrophe for his career, and he was busted from lieutenant general to a lowly lieutenant colonel of artillery. In reporting on operations in Mississippi, Joseph Johnston loaded him with blame, noting that he had been told under no circumstances to allow himself to be besieged. The South needed a scapegoat, and the northern-born Pemberton presented the ideal target. Jefferson Davis did not allow Johnston to wriggle free, criticizing him for his failure to attack Grant. Such was the success of Grant's parole program that much of Pemberton's army withered away, many demoralized men swearing never to fight again. While some soldiers violated their paroles and returned to the war, most headed home, further depleting the limited stock of Southern manpower. With none of the conquistador in his nature, Grant impressed most folks in Vicksburg with his unassuming, egalitarian nature. When he went to a barber shop for a haircut, an aide tried to shove Lieutenant Frank Parker from a chair to make room for him, but Grant refused to brush aside a junior officer. "You are all right, my friend. Go ahead," Grant said. "You feel just as much like getting cleaned up as any general, and you have got as much right to your turn as I have to mine." Parker was touched, since the hirsute Grant desperately needed a barber's attention. He looked rough, his beard was long and his hair was ragged, and his clothes were dusty and faded, but he never put on airs and never assumed to be a general. The short, plain man with the history of business failure now reigned as the leading northern general, although he still did not receive the adulation he might have garnered in the East. Armies in the Western theater roamed a vast, sprawling territory with comparatively scant newspaper coverage. The fall of Vicksburg rendered indefensible Port Hudson on the lower Mississippi, and on July 9th, its 7,000 defenders surrendered to Nathaniel Banks. Once again, the Mississippi became an open thoroughfare for commerce from the northern states. As Lincoln phrased it more poetically, "The father of waters again goes unvexed to the sea." Union control of the waterway sheared off Texas and Arkansas from the rest of the Confederacy, depriving it of western horses and cattle that had sustained its soldiers. For many Southerners, the loss of Vicksburg seemed to portend the demise of the Confederacy itself, and a fatalistic tone crept into their commentary. Dazed by this defeat, Jefferson Davis was more profoundly depressed by Vicksburg's loss than by Lee's simultaneous defeat at Gettysburg, moaning, "We are now in the darkest hour of our political existence." Josiah Gorgas, head of Confederate Ordnance, saw the South skidding on a permanent downward spiral. "Yesterday we rode on the pinnacle of success. Today absolute ruin seems to be our portion. The Confederacy totters to its destruction." Grant could now force his way into the vitals of the Confederacy instead of chipping away at its periphery. The glad tidings brightened the mood of Lincoln, who had been so worried about Vicksburg that his eyelids drooped and dark rings encircled his eyes. He was studying a map of Mississippi when a beaming Gideon Welles pranced in with a telegram from Admiral Porter fluttering in his hand. He executed a little jig and threw his hat into the air. "I have the honor to inform you that Vicksburg has surrendered to the U.S. forces on this 4th day of July." With a double dose of fantastic news from Vicksburg and Gettysburg, Lincoln, nearly euphoric, embraced Welles, proclaiming, "I cannot in words tell you my joy over this result. It is great, Mr. Welles, it is great." Lincoln directed Halleck to inform General Meade of what had happened, hoping it might inspire him to complete the demolition of Lee's army. The news produced such jubilation in official Washington that work ground to an abrupt halt. In government buildings, wrote the journalist Noah Brooks, the announcement of the news was received with cheer upon cheer from the crowds of officers and clerks, and I do not believe that there was much work done during the rest of the day. When a band serenaded Lincoln at the White House that evening, he toyed with a theme he would later rework into the Gettysburg Address. The idea of a war that would deliver on the unfinished promise of the Declaration of Independence. Until Vicksburg, the Western Theater had been something of a sideshow. Now Ulysses S. Grant, an uncomplaining man of proven competence, found a new place in Lincoln's affection. "He isn't shrieking for reinforcements all the time," Lincoln said. "He takes what troops we can safely give him and does the best he can with what he has got." The lesson of self-reliance Grant had learned before the war, when circumstances forced him to depend entirely on himself, now came in handy. "Grant is my man," the president insisted, "and I am his the rest of the war." Perhaps the highest honor bestowed on Grant was the privilege of direct correspondence with the president. Previously, their communication was mediated through Halleck and others. On July 13th, thankful for Vicksburg, Lincoln composed a noble letter to Grant. "I do not remember that you and I ever met personally. I write this now as a grateful acknowledgement for the almost inestimable service you have done the country." Lincoln admitted magnanimously that he had faulted Grant's strategy, believing that after crossing the Mississippi, he should have moved south and hooked up with Banks instead of shooting northeast toward Jackson. "I feared it was a mistake. I now wish to make the personal acknowledgement that you were right and I was wrong. Yours very truly, Abraham Lincoln." This lovely letter forged a bond between the two men that only grew stronger. With Grant, Lincoln no longer had to second-guess maneuvers or play the armchair general. Had he traveled west and gotten to know Grant personally, he might well have speeded up Grant's ascent to the top post and spared himself his frustrated dealings with several inept Eastern generals. Chaplain John Eaton met twice with Lincoln and reported back to Grant on the president's cordial feelings toward him, how he quoted from his dispatches and propped up a map of his operations on a tripod in his office. In a second-hand report from Dana, Lincoln had heard that Grant claimed he could not have taken Vicksburg without the Emancipation Proclamation, and the delighted president wished to have that verified. Once again, Grant's sympathy with the broad political aims of the war formed no minor part of his attraction in Washington. The magnitude of Grant's Vicksburg triumph helped to quiet, temporarily, the drinking issue. Admiral Porter told how Grant came aboard his ship at Vicksburg. "Wine was served, but Grant took none, only a cigar. And let me say here that this was his habit during all the time he commanded before Vicksburg." Lincoln dubbed Grant his fighting general and told Eaton of a congressional delegation that had lobbied for his ouster. "I asked why, and they said he sometimes drank too much and was unfit for such a position. I then began to ask them if they knew what he drank, what brand of whiskey he used, telling them most seriously that I wished they would find out, for if it made fighting generals like Grant, I should like to get some of it for distribution." Lincoln himself questioned the authenticity of this famous statement. "That would have been very good if I had said it," he told a cipher operator in the War Department, "but I reckon it was charged to me to give it currency." When Lincoln met General John Thayer, he quizzed him about Grant's drinking habit. "I have seen him often, sometimes daily," Thayer reassured him, "and I have never noticed the slightest indication of his using any kind of liquor. The charge is atrocious, wickedly false." Lincoln felt supremely vindicated by his implicit faith in Grant. "No man will ever know how much trouble I have had to carry my point about him. The opposition from several of our best Republicans has been so bitter that I could hardly resist it." The grand victory at Vicksburg also retired all residual doubts about Grant's skills as a general. Whether dealing with overall strategy or tactical minutiae, he had excelled. Vicksburg was a comeuppance for skeptics who had derided him. Halleck, having perversely turned against Grant after earlier victories, was swept along in the chorus of praise. In boldness of plan, rapidity of execution, and brilliancy of results, he announced to Grant, the Vicksburg operations will compare most favorably with those of Napoleon at Ulm. In the Bavarian town of Ulm, Napoleon had trapped the Austrian army, which surrendered without a fight. Even so waspish a critic as Henry Adams lauded Vicksburg as a military scheme such as Napoleon himself might have envied. In retrospect, Grant asserted that he could have improved upon every one of his Civil War campaigns, save one, Vicksburg. Many military historians rate it his masterpiece, the preeminent campaign waged by any general during the war. On July 7, 1863, Ulysses S. Grant was named Major General in the Regular Army, placing him firmly in control of his own military destiny. For a man drummed out of the regular army in disgrace a decade earlier, the move completed the spectacular transformation of his life. The promotion held deep psychological reverberations for the 41-year-old Grant as a West Pointer and career military man who called it the only promotion that I ever rejoiced in. After a lifetime of chronic insecurity, the promotion conferred recognition, a comfortable salary, and a lifelong cushion of financial support. Grant had long entertained the notion of taking Julia and the children to California someday, and being made a major general emboldened him to think he might do so after the war. Wartime hardship had dispersed his family. In the autumn, he thought of sending his two oldest sons to a boarding school in St. Louis, while Nellie stayed with Mrs. Boggs. "This breaking up of families is hard," he lamented after Vicksburg. "But such is war." That the Vicksburg conquest coincided with Lee's bloody defeat at Gettysburg leaned the war toward the Union side. No longer could Jefferson Davis seek legitimacy in European capitals. Vicksburg possessed deeper strategic meaning. Sherman called it the war's most decisive event. But Gettysburg received more extensive coverage in the Eastern press, leaving a more durable imprint on Northern opinion. The mystique of Robert E. Lee was dealt a heavy blow at Gettysburg. Spoiled by success, succumbing to hubris after Chancellorsville, he had come to believe the myth of his own invincibility. Unlike his Virginia battles, his foray into Maryland and Pennsylvania had forced him to fight on enemy territory. For once, it was the Northern Army that staked out an advantageous defensive position, and Lee who had to improvise. It was hard to see how even a string of Southern victories could defeat the North if Lee sustained such heavy losses. Confederate forces were being whittled down and could not be replaced by the South's smaller population. The sheer weight of Northern numbers began to tell. Although Lee assumed full responsibility for his baffling failure at Gettysburg, his reputation definitely suffered. After Vicksburg and Gettysburg, Northern soldiers were no longer quite so petrified of their Southern foes. Where Vicksburg had produced an acknowledged hero in Grant, Gettysburg produced a more dubious hero in George Gordon Meade, who had wanted to withdraw before Pickett's charge, but was overruled by his generals, then failed to follow up against the badly routed Confederates, allowing them to escape across the Potomac. Perhaps underestimating the difficulties involved, the president was furious at the missed opportunity. "If I had gone up there, I could have whipped them myself," he insisted. "Our army held the war in the hollow of their hand, and they would not close it." To make sure Meade got the message, Halleck wired him, "that the escape of Lee's army without another battle has created great dissatisfaction in the mind of the president." Curiously enough, Grant, who followed up victories aggressively, sympathized with Meade's sluggish response after Gettysburg, and emphasized charitably that he had been placed in charge of the Army of the Potomac only days before the battle. If Meade could have fought Lee 6 months later, when he had the army in his hand, I think Lee would have been destroyed. He was new to the chief command. He did not know how the army felt toward him, and having rolled back the tide of invasion, he felt that any further movement would be a risk. Lincoln and Stanton thought of elevating Grant to the helm of the Army of the Potomac, but aside from his attachment to the Western armies, Grant feared he would be ostracized as an interloper in the cliquish world of Virginia generals, and, encouraged by Sherman, stoutly resisted the move. As Grant told Dana on August 5th, "It would cause me more sadness than satisfaction to be ordered to the command of the Army of the Potomac. Here I know the officers and men, and what each general is capable of as a separate commander. There I would have all to learn. Here I know the geography of the country and its resources. There it would be a new study." Grant also feared leading an army that had ruined the career of a string of other generals. "I had seen so many generals fall, one after another, like bricks in a row, that I shrank from it," he commented in hindsight. From the time he emerged into the national spotlight, Grant disavowed political ambition as alien to his nature. "I am pulling no wires, as political generals do, to advance myself," he attested. "I have no future ambition." Yet Vicksburg conferred instant fame that could be parlayed into political success. According to some sources in the nation's capital, Congressman Washburn touted Grant for president with the same assiduity with which he had promoted his military career. General Benjamin Butler heard reports from Washington that Washburn was "making a business already of committing men to Grant for the presidency. I hear good men say he will go into the nominating convention stronger than Lincoln went." Washburn did nothing to dampen the boomlet, telling a friend that, "After old Abe is through with his next 4 years, we will put him," i.e. Grant, "in." The impetus for this came entirely from Washburn, not Grant, who wanted none of it. Perhaps it was the fear of advancing Grant's presidential prospects that made Lincoln hesitate in bringing him east as chief general in a more timely fashion. Grant worried that his firing of John McClernand still rankled Lincoln. A wily, persistent politician, McClernand stood ready to discredit Grant in government circles. To counter that, in late July, Grant dispatched his alter ego, John Rawlins, to deliver his Vicksburg report to the cabinet. Since Lincoln had never set eyes on Grant, Rawlins served as his proxy, and during a 2-hour presentation swayed the cabinet with his intelligence, sincerity, and self-evident passion. Incapable of guile, Rawlins disarmed skeptics. "His honest, unpretending, and unassuming manners pleased me. The absence of pretension, and I may say the unpolished and unrefined deportment of this earnest and sincere patriot and soldier, interested me more than that of almost any officer whom I have met," Secretary of the Navy Wells told his diary. Rawlins satisfied Lincoln that McClernand had obstructed operations at Vicksburg. Grant's timing here was superb. Lincoln could hardly indulge McClernand at the expense of the victor of Vicksburg. According to an officer who accompanied Rawlins, Lincoln paid an outstanding tribute to Grant. "That man Grant has been of more comfort to me than any other man in my army. He has few enemies, and he is not a politician. It don't matter where he turns up, he is on the side of victory. Things move wherever he is." Around this time, Grant sent in Rawlins' name for promotion to Brigadier General of Volunteers, claiming no officer had won a more honorable reputation. Rawlins duly received the appointment that August, testimony to his military skills and special protective relationship with Grant, and he also officially became his chief of staff. After Vicksburg fell, Rawlins discovered love in an unlikely place. Grant had set up headquarters in the roomy home of merchant William Lum and his wife Anna, who had taken in a governess from Danbury, Connecticut, Mary E. Hurlbut, always known as Emma. She had traveled south with friends before the war, entering the Lum household. Rollins was a rather prudish man who had now been a widower with three children for 2 years. He became captivated by the ringlets and laughing nature and rich good sense of Miss Hurlbut, who blushed furiously and fluttered her eyelids around him. She professed her loyalty to the Union, perfecting the romantic portrait for Rollins, who married her in Danbury before Christmas. Unfortunately, the event that promised to restore happiness to Rollins's life coincided with the continuing bout of bad health for him. By now, he had developed a rasping cough and other bronchial symptoms, contracting pleuropneumonia during the Vicksburg siege. Whether from stoicism or escapism, Rollins refused to acknowledge the illness and remained on active duty. For a long while, as the disease lengthened its tragic shadow over his life, Rollins explained away his symptoms as something minor. Even as Grant bemoaned the stifling heat, dust, and drought of Mississippi in July, he oversaw the final phases of the Vicksburg campaign. To Sherman, he had assigned the task of dismantling Joseph Johnston's army and eliminating any supplies and rolling stock it might possess. Grant's relations with Sherman had grown even more harmonious, and Sherman told visiting dignitaries how he had wrongly opposed Grant's Vicksburg campaign. "Nothing could be more generous than his treatment of me," said Grant, who successfully recommended Sherman for brigadier general in the regular army. Meanwhile, Sherman's foraging parties stripped the countryside of corn, cattle, hogs, sheep, poultry, and the new growing corn. Driven by ideological zeal, previewing a muscular style for which he became notorious in the South, Sherman informed Grant, "The wholesale destruction to which this country is now being subjected is terrible to contemplate." But the moralistic Sherman blamed the South for not employing the learned and pure tribunals established by America's forefathers to settle their grievances lawfully. He wanted Northern armies to impose military rule on the South, teaching it a lesson it would never forget. On the night of July 16th, after days of heavy shelling by Sherman, Johnston evacuated Jackson and fled east with his demoralized army, leaving Grant in undisputed control of the Mississippi heartland. "Jackson, once the pride and boast of Mississippi," Sherman observed, "is a ruined town." Less truculent than Sherman, though widely in agreement with his goals, Grant took a more lenient view of how to treat the local populace. "Impress upon the men the importance of going through the state in an orderly manner, abstaining from taking anything not absolutely necessary for their subsistence while traveling. They should try to create as favorable an impression as possible upon the people." To this end, Grant distributed food and medicine to needy residents. While both Grant and Sherman proved overly optimistic about the potential contrition of Southern citizens, the North experienced a vicious backlash against emancipation during New York City draft riots in mid-July. In March, Congress had enacted legislation that allowed men to escape the draft by hiring substitutes or paying $300 bounties to the government. Those eligible for the draft in New York's poor Irish Democratic neighborhoods vented their class rage against Republicans rich enough to evade the war and racial prejudice against free blacks who threatened them with economic competition. The ugliest aspect of the riots, which took more than 100 lives over 4 days, involved the outright murder of blacks on New York streets and the horrendous burning of the colored orphan asylum. Lincoln refused to rescind the draft and brought troops fresh from victory at Gettysburg to restore order. The New York riots magnified the glaring need to recruit more black soldiers, a policy Grant embraced with growing fervor. Once Vicksburg fell, he set about arming black soldiers with captured weapons and assigned them to reinforce the city's earthworks, collect and capture Confederate property, and police the city. Far from questioning their ability, Grant extolled them, telling Halleck that "Negro troops are easier to preserve discipline among than our white troops, and I doubt not will prove equally good for garrison duty." All that have been tried have fought bravely. Grant had gotten religion on the issue. I am anxious to get as many of these Negro regiments as possible and to have them full and completely equipped, he told Lorenzo Thomas. The large amount of arms and equipment captured here will enable me to equip these regiments as rapidly as they can be formed. Grant's conversion to this cause reflected his commonsensical approach to things. He had tested and observed black troops and was honest enough to credit their high-caliber performance. Also focusing Grant's mind on black recruitment were steady reminders from Washington. Now that he enjoyed direct correspondence with the president, Lincoln's priorities impressed themselves even more forcibly upon his mind. On August 9th, Lincoln told Grant that black recruitment was a resource which, if vigorously applied now, will soon close the contest. It works doubly, weakening the enemy and strengthening us. With the Mississippi open to commerce, Lincoln hoped 100,000 black soldiers could be assembled along its shores. In reply, Grant brought his views in exact conformity with national policy and presidential direction. I have given the subject of arming the Negro my hearty support, he assured the president. This, with the emancipation of the Negro, is the heaviest blow yet given the Confederacy. Lincoln was so pleased with this statement that he quoted it in a letter read aloud at a mass rally in Illinois in September, deepening the political bond between the two men. Intent on furthering Lincoln's vision, Grant planned to send an expedition into Louisiana to gather black recruits. As the results of the draft showed more people than expected buying their way out of service or flunking physicals, the drive to arm and equip black soldiers acquired fresh urgency. The most immediate issue demanding Grant's attention after Pemberton's surrender was what to do about slaves kept by rebel officers. A member of Pemberton's staff informed Grant that some slaves desired to return home to their masters, and that forcing them to separate was like severing families. Grant believed the decision should rest entirely with the blacks affected, and that no compulsory measures would be used to hold Negroes. I want the Negroes all to understand that they are free men. If slaves decided to return to their masters, Grant thought, there might be collateral benefits as they told others how Yankees offered to set them free, something that might incite further rebellion in the South. Grant's policy was revoked when Confederate officers openly coerced their slaves into returning home, and it became clear that no free choice was involved. Give instructions that no passes are to be given to Negroes to accompany their masters on leaving the city, Grant ordered. For his services to the black community, Grant began to bask in some of the adulation lavished upon Lincoln. A few days after Vicksburg fell, a northern woman, Annie Wittenmeyer, a sanitary agent from Iowa, invited Grant and McPherson to dine in a house that had been damaged by Union shells. That morning, she recalled, the colored children danced a jubilee when they found out Grant was coming, and began to throng around the house. Black faces were peeping out from the near houses, and the fences were black with colored people. It was perhaps the one chance of their lives to see their deliverer, the great captain who had opened the prison house of Vicksburg and given liberty to all the people. By the time Grant and McPherson left the house, every black person in the neighborhood knew that the shorter man was their hero. Ulysses S. Grant was a man of action par excellence, for whom idleness remained an enemy. Not content merely to hold conquered territory or retreat into summer quarters, he meditated fresh schemes for further campaigns, including an attack on Mobile, but he had to bow to certain realities that stalled his progress. For one thing, his weary troops could not manage extended marches in midsummer heat. For another, Lincoln and Halleck retained separate priorities, including checking European pretensions in Mexico and foreign meddling in the war. This meant that, for the sake of foreign policy, Grant had to divert an entire division to Nathaniel Banks to beef up the Union presence in Texas. In consequence, the restless Grant had to settle down and see myself put again on the defensive as I had been a year before in West Tennessee. It would have been an easy thing to capture Mobile at the time I proposed to go there. The temporary lull in fighting afforded him an opportunity to see the public adulation his success had generated. In late August, he went to Cairo to spend time with Julia before she placed their three eldest children in school in St. Louis. Grant seemed aglow with his new military renown, boasting to brother-in-law Fred Dent that, "I feel younger than I did 6 years ago," when business troubles smothered his spirits. Paying homage to Grant's talents, Memphis honored him with two dinners on consecutive nights. At the first, Grant responded with pitch-perfect brevity to a toast offered in his praise, having a staff officer reply crisply, "General Grant believes that he has no more than done his duty, for which no honor is due." For the rest of his life, banquets posed a challenge to Grant, who had to shield himself from alcoholic temptation. At the second Memphis dinner, John Eaton watched Grant handle this threat, especially when the mayor grew tipsy, spilled soup on Lorenzo Thomas, then splashed Grant while uncorking a champagne bottle. Amid the revelry, Grant made a point of abstaining from drink. His wine glasses and those of General Rawlins, his chief of staff, remained inverted throughout the dinner, noted Eaton, although there was even more than the usual freedom in the use of wines among the other guests. Grant again showed himself a master of pithy expression, acknowledging a toast with just two lines. "I thank you, gentlemen, for your kindness. All that will add to your prosperity that it is in my power to do, I will grant you." At the same time, Julia was being regaled as a newfound celebrity. Staying at a St. Louis hotel, she was entertained by serenaders, and a huge crowd burst into uproarious cheers when she appeared on the balcony. The one family member who tried to exploit Grant's renown was, predictably, his father, who had been barred from doing deals in his son's district after the notorious meddling that provoked General Orders No. 11. Now, in a virtual replay of that egregious incident, Jesse had the gall to lobby General Nathaniel Banks to yield commercial rights to a Mr. L. Block, one of a firm of five brothers doing business in Cincinnati. It seems unlikely Grant knew of this latest example of his father's unsavory business affairs. The unholy trinity of circumstances that inevitably challenged Grant, inactivity, a side trip to a distant town, and relaxation after the unbearable pressures of a major campaign, occurred on September 2nd when he journeyed to New Orleans to confer with Banks, stopping at the St. Charles Hotel. The visit's purpose was to review proposed operations west of the Mississippi. Grant's stay started with a magnificent reception for him at the Banks residence. "For hours, streams of people poured through the spacious parlors," reported a local paper. Grant received the storming party with as much coolness and calmness as he conducted those which assaulted the stout walls of Vicksburg. The next day, Grant hired a carriage with two spanking bays and drove Banks around the city at an exhilarating clip, leaving both horses drooping by the end. On September 4th, Banks staged a grand review in Grant's honor in the nearby suburb of Carrollton. By all accounts, it was a poignant moment for Grant, who at first trotted so briskly by the assembled troops that other generals had difficulty keeping pace. Then he paused on horseback in the shade of an oak tree, wearing his black felt hat and drawing on a cigar. As he surveyed passing troops, regiments carried banners inscribed with the names of his famous victories, and Grant tipped his hat to the veterans flashing by. Once the review was over, Grant and other participants repaired to a handsome déjeuner, music, wine, choruses, etc., and the wine mentioned may have been his undoing. Perhaps aware of Grant's reputation for taming frisky animals, Banks gave him a spirited but unbroken mount for the festivities, praising it as the fleetest and best. Grant characterized the steed as vicious and but little used, One observer noted the ominous detail that when the horse was first presented to Grant, it took two men to hold it. Afterward, Grant and other generals rode back to New Orleans on a road rutted by passing artillery, which had carved a gaping hole. Despite this, Grant's horse grew quite unmanageable and flew like the wind, said an observer. According to one version of what happened, Grant and the others engaged in a horse race, with Grant sprinting ahead of the pack. Then came disaster. General Grant's horse, in jumping that hole in the road, fell and threw the general clear over his head, said Lieutenant Frank Parker. Grant fell on his head and shoulders and lay flat out on the ground. We thought he was dead. In Grant's recollection, his horse reared at a shrill whistle issued by a locomotive. This frightened the animal so that he plunged into a carriage that was coming from the opposite direction and was thrown to the ground with me under. Ever the agile rider, Grant remained welded to his saddle as he fell, possibly aggravating the damage. His leg lay crushed and immobile, and his hip may have been dislocated. Yet another account asserted that a speeding horse came up behind Grant and trampled him severely. Whatever the case, he was knocked unconscious and carted on a litter to a nearby inn where he was confined to bed, unable to move his leg. My leg was swollen from the knee to the thigh, and the swelling, almost to the point of bursting, extended along the body up to the armpit, he recalled. The pain was almost beyond endurance. Grant would rely on crutches for 2 months and tapped Sherman as his preferred deputy in an emergency. Several, though hardly all, of the officers present attributed Grant's accident to drinking. I am frightened when I think that he is a drunkard, Banks told his wife. His accident was caused by this, which was too manifest to all who saw him. No less damaging in historical annals was a letter General William B. Franklin, a former West Point classmate of Grant's, subsequently wrote to McClellan about Grant's visit. He at once got into the most tremendous frolic, was drunk all over the city for 48 hours. After reviewing troops and eating lunch, Grant had galloped over an exceedingly dusty road, full split, tumbled head over heels, and was badly hurt. This report reverberated through the years, and as late as 1885, Mark Twain reported that Franklin saw Grant tumble from his horse drunk while reviewing troops in New Orleans. In another letter, Franklin blamed Grant's lapse on Julia's absence. When I saw Grant in Vicksburg about August 1st, he was perfectly straight and told me that he had drunk nothing during the war. I was, as you can imagine, somewhat surprised when I saw him in New Orleans. But Mrs. Grant, a cross-eyed, very ugly woman, was at Vicksburg, and there was no such woman at New Orleans. Sylvanus Cadwallader, the unreliable journalist who embellished Grant's drinking at Satartia, remembered gossip swirling around Grant's headquarters that he was thrown from his horse on his return from a review of General Banks's troops, and that it was solely due to his drinking. As with many Grant drinking stories, the most lurid versions emanated from generals hostile to Grant. Franklin was a protege of McClellan and had bungled 2 battles in the Eastern Theater before Lincoln banished him to Louisiana for scheming to get McClellan reinstated. Friendlier generals, such as Cadwallader Washburn, made no allusion to drinking, even when writing to his brother Elihu about the fall. And if Grant was drunk, how did he have enough self-command to remain in the saddle? What lends most credence to the tale that Grant had been drunk was that John Rawlins heard it from people present and believed it. A couple of months later, suspecting a new drinking spree, he sent his fiancée an exasperated letter. I had hoped, but it appears vainly, his New Orleans experience would prevent him ever again indulging with this, his worst enemy. The episode stands out because Grant usually had enough self-control to drink only in private, far from inquisitive eyes, whereas the New Orleans incident occurred in full view of high-ranking officers, some of them sworn rivals. While the accident handicapped Grant for a couple of months, it did not interfere with any battles. propped up by hotel pillows, Grant smoked, read a humorous book, and soldiered on with his usual equanimity, but mostly he lay flat on his back, unable to leave bed without assistance for several weeks. By September 16th, taken back to Vicksburg, he settled in an upstairs bedroom of the beautiful Lum mansion, enjoying a fine view of the river. Here, Julia and their youngest boy, Jesse, lent a hand, Julia taking up nursing duties beside his bed and fanning him in the oppressive heat. Not until the end of the month did Grant start to maneuver with crutches. During this period of enforced rest, an overriding concern was the formation of black regiments, and he urged Eaton to create a colored military force that would resist attacks from the bands of guerrillas that infested the country and threatened the plantations. From these bedside discussions arose the 63rd and 64th United States Colored Infantry Regiments, enhancing the status of black soldiers in the Union Army. While Grant recuperated, momentous events were reshaping the war in eastern Tennessee. On September 2nd, Ambrose Burnside captured Knoxville, and William Rosecrans took Chattanooga on September 9th. These twin victories seemed to fulfill Lincoln's dream of prying loose eastern Tennessee from the enemy. Confederate leaders decided to contest this terrain vigorously, and Jefferson Davis expanded Braxton Bragg's army by transferring from Virginia two divisions under James Longstreet. On September 19th, this strengthened force clashed with the Army of the Cumberland under Rosecrans at Chickamauga Creek, near Chattanooga in northwestern Georgia. At first, the battle seemed a furious, bloody struggle devoid of strategic design, a mad, irregular battle in which one army was bushwhacking the other, and wherein all the science and the art of war went for nothing, said a Union general. Then, on September 20th, Union resistance crumbled as Confederates pierced a gap that opened in the enemy line. The dispatch that Charles Dana filed with Edwin Stanton evoked the enormity of the disaster that had befallen Union forces. "My report today is of deplorable importance. Chickamauga is as fatal a name in our history as Bull Run. Never in any battle I have witnessed was there such a mass of cannon and musketry. Confederate troops came through with resistless impulse. Before them our soldiers turned and fled. It was wholesale panic. Vain were all attempts to rally them. The road is full of a disordered throng of fugitives. We have lost heavily in killed today. The total of our killed, wounded, and prisoners can hardly be less than 20,000, and maybe much more." Besides the rebels' capture of more than 8,000 Union prisoners, a rich trove of weaponry tumbled into their hands. For the Federal side, the sole redeeming feature came when the quietly determined General George H. Thomas and his men refused to buckle under Confederate assault. For his bravery, Thomas chalked up legendary status as the Rock of Chickamauga. As Rosecrans's ragged, dispirited army retreated to the safety of Chattanooga, his reputation lay in ruins. Grant had shared the general affection for him, telling Halleck the previous year, "There are two men in this army whom I would just as soon serve under as to have them serve under me. One is Sherman, the other is Rosie." Another time, Grant spoke of Rosecrans tenderly as his warm personal friend, and one of the ablest and purest of men both in motive and action. For all that, Rosecrans was weak, vain, and irresolute, lacking Grant's superlative drive and focus, a terrible procrastinator who constantly clamored for more troops. At Chickamauga, he behaved with such shocking cowardice as he fled the battlefield that even Lincoln sneered he was confused and stunned like a duck hit on the head. One officer who saw Rosecrans said he would not soon forget the terrible look of the brave man stunned by sudden calamity. The situation of his army in Chattanooga, left with only a 10-day supply of rations, was fraught with peril. Enemy forces had seized the commanding heights of Missionary Ridge on the city's eastern side, and Lookout Mountain to the southwest, leaving him dependent upon a single, often impassable road through the mountains to sustain his large army. The threat of starvation loomed with winter's approach. Chattanooga was also a critical railway hub, and the Union could ill afford to lose it. Stanton rushed off a telegraph to the bedridden Grant to relieve Rosecrans with all available forces, and he promptly dispatched two divisions. Led by Sherman, one division set off by steamer from Vicksburg to Memphis only 12 hours after Grant got the order. Sherman never forgot this dreadful voyage. He had dragged along his family, including his oldest son, Willie, who became feverish and began to lose strength rapidly. A regimental doctor diagnosed him with typhus, and Willie expired not long after the boat docked at Memphis, leaving Sherman disconsolate. "This is the only death I have ever had in my own family, and falling as it has so suddenly and unexpectedly on the one I most prized on earth has affected me more than any other misfortune could," he confided to Grant. "I can hardly compose myself enough for work, but must and will do so at once." Sherman, though he persevered in his duties, was haunted by the specter of the dead boy. "Sleeping, waking, everywhere I see poor Willie," he told his wife. Stanton placed such a premium on rescuing Rosecrans that he undertook the war's most strenuous logistical feat to save him. At a late-night War Department meeting, he proposed sending 20,000 troops from the Army of the Potomac to Tennessee, a proposal of such fiendish complexity that Lincoln laughingly said the Army could not get one corps from Northern Virginia into Washington in the time you fix for reaching Nashville. In no mood for drollery, Stanton rejoined that the danger was too imminent and the occasion too serious for jokes. With his formidable energy, Stanton studied railway timetables and proceeded to shift 20,000 men and 3,000 horses to Chattanooga in 11 days. The obstacles were daunting. The troops had to cover 1,233 miles, including crossing the Appalachian Mountains and twice fording the Ohio River, making the successful move a tour de force of military organization. On October 3rd, Halleck alerted Grant that Stanton wished him to travel at once to Nashville via Cairo and supervise the transfer of troops from the West. It took a week for the message to reach Grant. "I was still very lame," recalled Grant, who needed help getting on and off horses, "but started without delay." Eaton accompanied him on the 6-day steamboat ride from Vicksburg to Cairo and remembered how Rawlins hectored the skipper with manic urgency. The old river boat was rushed along at a speed which seemed as if it might prove fatal at any moment, and the keel would scrape and grind the river bottom in the most disturbing fashion. As Grant journeyed east, the drumbeat of criticism of Rosecrans swelled in volume. Posted at Chattanooga, Charles Dana plied Stanton with critical comments about Rosecrans, stating that despite his well-known affability, he lacked firmness and steadiness of will and should be sacked. Dana's dispatches grew more sardonic, then downright insulting. On October 12th, he opined that the practical incapacity of the general commanding is astonishing, and it often seems difficult to believe him of sound mind. His imbecility appears to be contagious. All the while, Rawlins badgered Grant with reminders of Rosecrans's general spirit of insubordination. Lincoln grew convinced that Rosecrans had to be cashiered, but for political reasons wanted to wait a short while. The popular Rosecrans hailed from Ohio, and Lincoln preferred to temporize until after the Ohio gubernatorial election on October 13th, which Republicans won. When Grant reached Cairo on October 16th, leaning on a crutch, he learned that an unnamed War Department official planned to meet him at the Galt House in Louisville. Setting off for Kentucky, he changed trains at Indianapolis and was about to leave the station when a messenger rushed up to notify him that Stanton and Governor John Bruff of Ohio had arrived on an adjoining track. While Grant and Stanton had communicated via telegraph, they had never set eyes on each other. Short of breath, asthmatic, snuffling with a heavy cold, The short, stout Stanton barged brusquely into Grant's car, eyed the officers present, then began to pump the hand of a bearded man with an army hat whom he assumed was Grant. "How do you do, General Grant?" he cried. "I recognize you from your pictures." Stanton was embarrassed to learn he was shaking hands with Grant's medical director, Dr. Edward Kitto. If Grant was amused by the confusion, Stanton was badly flustered, and it darkened his mood for the rest of the journey to Louisville with Grant. Stanton later admitted that in guessing which officer was Grant, he had eliminated the real Grant because he looked much too ordinary and wasn't the prepossessing figure he had imagined. The war secretary presented a picturesque foil to the general. With thick spectacles that he wiped incessantly and a long, gray-tinged black beard that almost seemed to rest on his chest, Edwin McMaster's Stanton was easy to admire, hard to love. Heedless of political pressure, impatient with special pleading, he was a snappish, short-tempered man who enjoyed barking orders at terrified subordinates. He had been something of a surprise choice to replace Simon Cameron a year before. Back in 1855, Lincoln, a junior lawyer, was brought in to defend a client in a patent suit and had tangled with Stanton, a high-priced Pittsburgh practitioner who acted as one of the main defense attorneys. Stanton was contemptuous of Lincoln and made no attempt to conceal it. "Why did you bring that damned long-armed ape here?" Stanton allegedly asked his chief co-counsel. "He does not know anything and can do you no good." Later on, he added, "The original gorilla, a low cunning clown, and that giraffe," to his litany of colorful epithets for Lincoln. A Democrat who served briefly as Attorney General under President Buchanan, Stanton seemed to have the wrong resume for Lincoln's cabinet. But the War Department under Cameron was tarred with corruption allegations, and Stanton was exactly the scourge needed to clean it up. To introduce bureaucratic transparency, Stanton stood behind a high desk in a public space in the War Department, delivering stern lectures to shady contractors or self-promoting officers. He came across as an unstoppable force with an overbearing sense of mission that brooked no dissent. If many people thought him an ogre, nobody ever questioned his incorruptible honesty or ruthless efficiency. His memory was prodigious, as was his capacity for work and scrupulous attention to detail. He was the managerial genius of a war that made stupendous logistical demands on the Northern Army, with its long supply lines, extensive rail and telegraphic networks, and distant factories. He developed a surprisingly good relationship with Lincoln because he got things done and was not especially concerned with legal niceties. He could be tyrannical in exercising power and heedless of civil liberties. "If I tap that little bell," he pointed out to one visitor, "I can send you to a place where you will never hear the dogs bark." Stanton cared little for the feelings of others. Grant was fascinated by how Lincoln got his way through charm and sensitivity, while Stanton prevailed through uncompromising truculence. With his imperturbable calm, Grant was a little leery of Stanton's high-strung, domineering nature, yet the two men struck up an excellent working accord. "I don't think that Stanton was what I might call a cordial friend," Grant explained. "He was always courteous. Our friendship grew very slowly. I liked him very much better than he liked me, I think. But I must say, as Secretary of War, he was extremely loyal and true." Especially important to Grant was the ample leeway Stanton gave him. "He has never dictated a course of campaign to me," Grant testified, "and never inquired what I was going to do." Grant stood in awe of Stanton's efficiency. He was a man who never questioned his own authority and who always did in wartime what he wanted to do. He was an able constitutional lawyer and jurist, but the Constitution was not an impediment to him while the war lasted. Until the end of his life, and despite many strains that later marred their relationship, Grant deemed Stanton one of the great men of the Republic and a martyr to the Union cause. Throughout the train ride, Grant and Stanton remained locked in a deep, searching conversation. By the time they pulled into Louisville that night, in a cold, drizzling rain, Stanton had handed Grant two orders from Lincoln. One created a brand new military division of the Mississippi that consolidated the armies of the Ohio, Cumberland, and Tennessee. Grant was placed atop this grand structure, giving him power over a huge western territory stretching from the Appalachian Mountains to the Mississippi River, with the exception of Banks's Southwest Command. With his headquarters in the field, there was no chance Grant could vegetate in an office. Sherman became head of the Army of the Tennessee, and Burnside kept the Army of the Ohio. As for the Army of the Cumberland, Stanton gave Grant the option of replacing Rosecrans with George Thomas. People flocked to the Galt House in Louisville to glimpse Grant, and some were taken aback that he seemed so much smaller in life. "I thought he was a large man," proclaimed a puzzled observer.
"He would be considered a small chance of a fighter if he lived in Kentucky."
Grant, still lame, leaned on a crutch or cane, but was so comfortable in the saddle that one reporter believed, even in his feeble condition, it would require a strong effort on the part of the horse to unseat him. After a day of intense consultation with Stanton, Ulysses and Julia Grant took the evening off to attend the theater. Their short-lived leisure was interrupted by an emergency summons from Stanton, who had been frantically trying to locate Grant. When Grant arrived at the hotel at about 11 o'clock, he found Stanton, with a severe cold, pacing the floor rapidly in his dressing gown. His agitation had been precipitated by a letter from Dana saying Rosecrans planned to abandon Chattanooga unless stopped from doing so. Grant thought a retreat would be catastrophic, surrendering a strategic spot and threatening the loss of an entire army with irreplaceable artillery. At this critical juncture, he assumed official command of the military division of the Mississippi, replaced Rosecrans with Thomas, and told the stalwart Thomas to cling to Chattanooga at all hazards. Thomas sent back a message that throbbed with determination. "We will hold the town till we starve." After numerous mistakes in selecting generals, Lincoln and Stanton had weeded out the weak reeds and began to assemble the team that would win the war. Grant's ascent was simply stunning. As Rawlins told his fiancée, "This is now the most important command in the United States, involving immense labor, unceasing watchfulness, and anxiety. I feel a confidence in General Grant's ability to master the whole and turn again, as heretofore, the tide of defeat and disaster." The general public was amazed by Rosecrans's swift fall from grace.
"Rosecrans is superseded by Grant," the diarist George Templeton Strong exclaimed in New York. "The change astonishes everyone. Its alleged reasons are still more startling. Opium eating, fits of religious melancholy, and gross personal misconduct at Chickamauga are charged by newspaper correspondents." Increasingly sure-footed in military strategy, Lincoln displayed growing toughness in hiring and firing generals. As the journalist Noah Brooks observed, "It is hard to give up a popular idol. No man in the nation was more pained at the necessity of the removal of General Rosecrans than was the president himself." Whatever his earlier fondness for Rosecrans, Grant grew withering in his contempt for him, telling Halleck a year later that any general will be better than Rosecrans, and advising Dana that Rosecrans should be shipped off to the northern frontier with the duty of detecting and exposing rebel conspiracies in Canada. Rosecrans turned into an impassioned foe of Grant, later penning a venomous article entitled "The Mistakes of Grant." On October 20th, Grant proceeded as expeditiously as possible to Chattanooga, making the first leg of his journey by train. Passing through Nashville, he saw that Grant mania had overtaken the army, with soldiers crowding the tracks and craning their necks to spot him. He disembarked from the train to meet a man who would figure significantly in his future: Andrew Johnson, the military governor of Tennessee. The laconic Grant had his first experience of Johnson's long-winded style. As they stood together before the St. Cloud Hotel, Johnson delivered a lengthy welcome speech, while Grant, by his own admission, stood in torture, fearing something would be expected from me in response. I was relieved, however, the people assembled having apparently heard enough. Grant charmed the throng by admitting he had never made a speech in his life and was too old to learn now. Far from enjoying his glory, Grant sometimes exhibited a melancholy air, as if burdened by responsibility. After spending the night in Nashville, he boarded a train, and as it slid through Tennessee, a soldier named Harvey Reed saw Grant sitting alone, wrapped in thought. He had on an old blue overcoat and wore a common white wool hat drawn down over his eyes and looked so much like a private soldier that but for the resemblance to the photographs that can be seen on every corner in this town, it would have been impossible to have recognized him. He was either tired with riding all night or had something on his mind, for he appeared almost sad as he looked vacantly without seeming to see anything that he was passing. By early evening, Grant reached Stevenson, just across the border from Tennessee in northern Alabama. With difficulty, he dismounted from the train and stood on the platform, resting on his crutches and awaiting a train that would bear the disgraced Rosecrans. One Union soldier noted the absence of any grand aura surrounding Grant. An army slouch hat with bronze cord around it, quite a long military coat, unbuttoned, no sword or belt, and there was nothing to indicate his rank. When the boys called for a speech, he bowed and said nothing. While at the train station, Grant conferred with Rosecrans, who energetically disputed Dana's accusation that he planned to desert Chattanooga. Far from being despondent, Grant found Rosecrans very cheerful, as though a great weight had been lifted off his mind. Rosecrans outlined plans to supply his isolated army, and Grant found it a highly productive meeting, with the demoted general laying out some excellent suggestions as to what should be done. My only wonder was that he had not carried them out. At Stevenson, Grant also met General Oliver Otis Howard, who had lost an arm in Virginia the year before and was nicknamed the Christian General for his piety and aversion to alcohol. Howard was surprised by the slight, diminutive Grant, finding him rather thin in flesh and very pale in complexion and noticeably self-contained and retiring. Grant spent the night sharing Howard's tent, which was pitched on a muddy flat. Howard remembered one comical, if slightly awkward, moment. When Grant first came in, there was hanging against the wall of my tent an empty liquor flask. His eyes twinkled, and I saw a faint smile creep over his face. Before he could speak, I said, "General, that flask is not mine. It was brought here by an officer from Chattanooga. I do not drink." Grant answered quietly, "Neither do I." And surely, at that period of his career, he was not drinking, and I never knew him to take even a glass of wine during the Chattanooga campaign. Howard came away enormously impressed with Grant. "He is modest, quiet, and thoughtful," he informed his wife. "He looks the picture of firmness." The last 60 miles to Chattanooga had to be made on horseback and constituted the most harrowing ride of Grant's life. Rawlins portrayed the trail as the roughest and steepest ever crossed by army wagons and pack mules. This wretched mountain road, which constantly rose and fell, was the only supply route still open linking the besieged Union Army in Chattanooga with the outside world. Grant had to be lifted onto his horse. Rawlins deposited him gently, as if he had been a child, with his crutches strapped to the side. Heavy rains stirred up the road into a froth of knee-deep mud, and in some places the path was washed away by mudslides. At the worst spots, Grant had to be taken off his horse and lifted over hurdles, an ordeal he endured with stoic fortitude. He also had to contend with the appalling sight of smashed wagons everywhere and the potent stench of thousands of dead mules and horses which had been killed by rebel bayonets or starved to death. As the cavalcade approached Chattanooga, torrential rains left the beleaguered party dark, wet, and hungry, as Dr. Kiddo told Julia Grant. Just as they made their way into Chattanooga, Grant's horse tipped over and fell flat on his side, but by a miraculous stroke of luck, he was spared further injury.